This is Ozarks at Large for Thursday, October 22nd, 2020, on your public radio station, 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. Surprise, we're here at noon, after I spent all day telling you we wouldn't have a noon show because of live NPR coverage of the vote with the Judiciary Committee in the U.S. Senate about Amy Coney Barrett. Well, they moved up the schedule. It happened. Here we are. It's 2020. You roll with the punches. Ahead on this noon show, Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda talks with Jim Rollins, the president of Northwest Arkansas Technical Institute, about tomorrow's dedication of a new building, the first building on the NWTI campus in two decades. And Mark Criss discusses the book he edited, The War at Home, Perspectives on the Arkansas Experience During World War I. There was a foreign war, violence against people of color, and a pandemic. What was the same and what was different about Arkansas 101 years ago? That's discussed later on today's show. 14 Arkansas counties are reporting at least 20 new cases of COVID-19, according to the Arkansas Department of Health's numbers yesterday. There are 981 new confirmed cases, another 174 probable cases. The ADH is reporting 23 confirmed deaths, bringing Arkansas's fatalities from the virus to 1,751. Hospitalizations decreased by one during the last 24-hour period. The number of active cases in the state now numbers more than 8,500. So far this month, there have been nearly 198,000 PCR tests administered in Arkansas and another 26,000 antigen tests. There are now five confirmed cases of the virus among Arkansas legislators. Senators Missy Irvin of Mountain View and Terry Rice of Waldron have tested positive, as have State Representatives Joe Cloud of Russellville, Stu Smith of Batesville, and Michelle Gray of Melbourne. Early voting numbers in Washington County continue to be on a pace ahead of early voting in the 2016 presidential election. Yesterday, about 1,700 more votes were cast than on the third day of early voting 4 years ago. So far, there have been 5,100 more early votes cast in 2020 than 2016 in Washington County through the first 3 days of early voting. Good Thursday. This is Ozarks at Large. Northwest Technical Institute is dedicating the new Byrd Welding Center tomorrow. It's the first new building to be constructed on the Springdale campus in 20 years. Students have been transitioning into the building during the past month. Yesterday, Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda spoke with NWTI President Jim Rollins about the dedication and what the new center will mean for the institution's welding program.
We're a workforce development institution, an experience-based, a hands-on learning institution. And welding, obviously, is a major need in our workforce in the region. Manufacturing of every imaginable type and all of the industry needs in the area require skilled welders. And we've been working in partnership with industry leaders over time, and they've had a major voice in terms of the needs of the building, the scale, the scope of the building, the partnerships that are springing up as a result of this new facility is amazing. And there's some bias, I expect, in this assumption, but I really believe this may well be the finest facility of this type in our state. And so we're elated about that. And, of course, right across the parking lot, we have a second major addition coming forward on our campus. The ammonia refrigeration facility is being expanded. And upon completion, which I think will take place in the next few months, that may well be the finest facility in the nation. So you'll want to stay close to that as well. A lot of great things happening at NWTI.
Absolutely. Well, tell me a little bit more about the welding center. How big is it and how is it improving upon the program that you already had?
Probably in the 14 to 15,000 square foot area. There's two major classrooms in the facility. When you think of welding, you may or may not think of a high-tech facility, but this is a high-tech facility, one-to-one technology for all students in the program. So looking at design, creativity, all the metallurgy, science that goes into it, all call for that kind of technology, and we're so pleased to have that aspect of it as well. In the last 3 or 4 weeks, the students at the school have been partners in terms of assembling new equipment in the facility. We've had numerous partners locally and at the state level who've helped us with purchase acquisitions. But there's in the neighborhood of $650,000 to $700,000 in terms of welding equipment that's there, state-of-the-art equipment. And so we think every imaginable need in welding is either in place or will be put in place in the months ahead.
How does this compare to what your program was before? How much more space does it give you, or how many more students can you take on because of this facility? Yeah,
we're working with both high school students and post-secondary students. We think we'll graduate at least 80 or so welders per year in this program. And when you look at that over time, that easily doubles, if not even a greater multiplier in terms of students with appropriate credentials going into the workplace and for establishing partners like Northwest Arkansas Steel. As we meet with them, they tell us they will take from 6 to 12 in that one business each year. So there's a real need out there, and our school's responding to that need. And this new facility is just going to accentuate our ability to close that workforce gap. One needs to keep in mind that the school also in this area has community-based programs where adults in the community who may have an interest, may be upskilling, if you will. We're offering those programs in the evening. And then as we move our services out into the area high schools, we have satellite programs at a number of schools that will also be addressing welding needs. So we believe that NWTI clearly will be the primary provider of welding graduates each year.
So how has running that campus been like in the middle of a pandemic? One of the things that's so unique about NWTI is how hands-on it is. You know, there's a lot of hands-on training for these skilled jobs. So what are some of the things that you've had to do to ensure that these classes can continue during this pandemic?
Well, I really want to give tremendous credit to Robin Eason and to our entire staff. We've worked together as a team to put together a model that kind of distributed the instruction. It allowed us to spread out. Social distancing has been a priority. Obviously, wearing of masks, sanitation at the highest level, minimizing groups, if you will, group contacts. Every recommendation that came from CDC has been considered and implemented in our school. We are a safety-first institution. With all that said, we still have incidences where students maybe have been in groups and in their personal lives, et cetera, and have been exposed. And so, like all institutions, we're experiencing the quarantine issues from time to time, but the staff has responded well, and we understand that's a part of the conditions that we have to have school in. And I'm very proud of our team and, frankly, very proud of our students. They have honored what we've asked them to do, and I think the impact has been minimal to this point.
So the dedication is at 10 a.m. Friday morning. Is the public welcome? I know that the governor had planned on coming, but maybe isn't coming now because of his exposure to COVID.
We have to take a number of precautions to limit the participation in the building itself. And we're creating Zoom opportunities back to the main campus where every staff, all of our students can be involved. But we expect to have in the neighborhood of 150 or so individuals at site for face-to-face participation in the dedication, but they are spread out and we'll be wearing of our mask. Again, every safety precaution will be taken. Our governor told us, kind of got the inkling yesterday and more officially this morning, apparently himself has been exposed and he is being quarantined, and you would certainly expect that. We would love to have him with us on Friday, but it's just not going to be possible at this point. And we understand that. Hope things go really well for him.
Well, thank you so much for your time this morning. I certainly appreciate it. And good luck with the dedication. I hope it goes well.
Thank you so much. I've enjoyed it.
That was Jim Rollins, president of Northwest Technical Institute, speaking with Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda. You can find out more about the school's programs at nwti.edu. Just more than 100 years ago, Arkansans were dealing with multiple crises at home and away. There was a foreign war, violence against people of color, economic challenges, and confusion over how to deal with an infectious pandemic. The similarities and differences of those times compared to ours are examined in the book, The War at Home, Perspectives on the Arkansas Experience During World War I, recently published by the University of Arkansas Press. The 9 chapters, written by 9 different historians, cover how women moved into the workforce, cover the Elaine race riot, and the 1919 influenza epidemic. Earlier this month, I talked with the editor of the book, Mark Crist. He acknowledges there are eerie parallels between then and now.
It's almost scary in some ways. You know, I mean, we're at war and have been for years. You know, we're in the midst of a global pandemic. Racial unrest is rampant in the United States. And we have a president, as we did then, who was not exactly liberal in their racial perspectives.
When considering these 9 chapters, because I think for many of us, if we read about 1918, 1919, 1920, and World War I is part of the story, you hear about the doughboys, you hear about how you're going to keep them on the farm, that sort of thing. One of the things I love about The War at Home, Perspectives on the Arkansas Experience During World War I, is the so many different perspectives that are considered. That's something you don't find in a lot of history books about that era. What kind of approach did you and the authors take towards making sure it was more well-rounded?
Well, again, you know, it really kind of worked out from the start with the way we did our symposia. You know, we identified themes that we thought needed to be addressed, and then my philosophy in doing edited works like this is to pretty much give the scholars you know, this is what we'd like to do, and then let them follow the trail down the rabbit hole as they see fit. And 9 times out of 10 turns out really nicely, and I think that's the case here.
I enjoyed reading about Camp Pike, which is later Camp Robinson, and the role it played in kind of the conduit between Arkansas men and Europe. An interesting chapter.
Yes, and the author of that, Ray Screws, is the curator or the director of the National Guard Museum that's located at Camp Robinson. So he had a lot of insights from the in-depth research that he's done on site on the history and development of Camp Pike. And with all of these, we also wanted him to kind of look at, you know, how these different themes still resonate today. And of course, you know, Camp Pike is still one of the key military training institutions in the United States.
There's an interesting graphic that comes from the newspaper at Camp Pike at the time, which was called The Trench and Camp. And it's kind of a recruitment effort to get athletes to join the Army. And it says the runner would be good for going over the top quickly, I guess, of a trench, mm-hmm. or the ball player, the baseball player, good for throwing a grenade, the boxer,
right.
Making an expert bayonet user. It's in one way archaic, but in another way, kind of chilling.
Yeah. It's, I mean, that publication really was in a lot of ways a propaganda piece, propaganda organ for the base. And it, that particular illustration really, you know, kind of reaches out to all these folks from around the country who have different skills that, you can convert your sporting expertise to mayhem on the battlefield.
Of course, we the readers have the benefit of history, and we know what movements begin to take off and what don't. And it's very interesting. I think of women and operators, phone operators in Fort Smith during World War I, and they were striking for better conditions and more money, weren't they?
Right. Yes, in Fort Smith, and everybody knows about Rosie the Riveter, but this was really the first time that a lot of women got jobs, outside of the domestic realm. There's one, I believe it's in Jeannie Wayne's piece, where a lot of the male streetcar conductors in Little Rock quit rather than work with female streetcar conductors.
And of course, 1919 was the year that the Elaine massacre happened, and it's recounted here as well. What do we find out about what was one of the worst race riots in United States history?
Well, Brian Mitchell wrote that essay, and he focused on the veterans who were involved in both sides. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, you had African Americans who had gone to Europe, from the Arkansas Delta. They'd gone to Europe and found that in Europe they were treated with respect and dignity. And when they came back to Arkansas, it was just back to the same old Jim Crow existence, and they weren't willing to put up with it, which, led to them organizing the union there at Hoopsburg Church. Among the posse, if you will, who went after these African Americans were members of the American Legion from Helena, who were themselves also veterans of World War I.
And of course, influenza, different strains, and we find out that there were grand conversations, grand controversies over whether to have quarantines, whether to institute policies that would make people separate. That really rings true. When you were working on this, when it started, of course, I guess when you were first reading that article and all these articles, it was pre-pandemic for us, right?
It was. And as our current pandemic, rolled out, I kept going back to that essay by Tom DeBlack and saying, well, okay, right on time. This is it's time for this argument and this action by the government. It's really kind of eerie.
Yeah, down to, concerns about as autumn came in and the cases went up and were cases affecting one population disproportionately than the other. It is very scary.
Right, and the Tom goes quite a bit into how it affected the schools and universities around the state, and we're really seeing that play out now 100 years later, in lockstep with what happened a century ago.
Yeah, and there are letters, someone writing a letter to someone in Fayetteville and said, oh my goodness, if you go into quarantine, you won't be able to meet me at the train station. I hope
right.
There isn't a quarantine.
And people weren't any more happy about a lot of people weren't any more happy about the mandates that were called out then than are now. But scientifically, medically, it made as much sense then as it does now. And you'll see a lot of pictures from that era of whole families with masks on. I saw one recently that they were standing there and they had the family cat with a mask on as well.
As a historian, someone who has, devoted your adult life and your professional life to history, were there surprises for you as these essays and chapters came to you?
Yes. One that had some surprises for me was Carl Drexler's piece on manufacturing in Arkansas, the ramp up of manufacturing for the war industry, and this huge picric acid plant that was placed out near what is now the Little Rock Airport. None of the plant remains anymore, but the manpower shortage was so great at that time that they couldn't find enough local people to work the plant. So they actually dragooned barbers and waiters and, you know, non-essential personnel to work there. And when they still couldn't get enough, they brought in folks from Puerto Rico to work at the plant. And, you know, Puerto Rico is a much more moderate climate than Arkansas is. And as winter came and the winter pandemic and the flu pandemic hit the town, a lot of these Puerto Rican people just died by the hundreds. Mm.
Yeah, I can't imagine. I mean, it's been difficult enough for Governor Hutchinson to try to get a mask mandate observed. I can't imagine dragooning barbers away from their shop to make them work in a manufacturing plant.
Yeah, I'm sure there was plenty of squawking then, too.
You know, those of us who are amateur historians or you know, sort of love to read history can have this idea that, oh, history does repeat itself, and that's probably a dangerous thing. But what do you take away when reading the events of 100 years ago and comparing them to now? Is that a dangerous game to play, or can you learn some things that might still be applied a century later?
Well, yeah, yes, you can, and I think really the medical issues, the pandemic issues, are really the key thing to look at there, in that you know, the it's the same kind of viral virus that you know, simple mask wearing is one of the best things you can do to avoid it. You know, 100 years ago they were saying wash your hands, don't share washcloths, don't share towels. You know, the science hasn't changed any, just the bug has. And also and not so much right now, but you know, the mobilization that took place, you know, the industrial mobilization in World War I has been, you know, repeated several times in the decades since then.
When a conversation is happening in 2120, you and I won't be here, but there's a new book from that has been put out about what's going on now. Do you, as a historian, allow yourself to think what future historians or future readers of history might think 100 years from now about right now?
Well, that's an interesting question. I don't really dwell on that much. I'm sadly rooted in the past, but in you know, in doing things like the centennial commemoration, you know, part of my thought was always on, you know, what can we do now that will still be here 100 years from now, and this book was one part of that commemoration. Another one was we had working with the Arkansas Forestry Commission, we had a memorial tree planted in each of Arkansas's 75 counties, and you know, with luck, those will still be growing, providing shade a century from now, and perhaps giving people reason to think back on the events of what would then be 200 years ago.
Mark Crist edited the book The War at Home: Perspectives on the Arkansas Experience During World War I, recently published by the University of Arkansas Press. And yeah, you may recognize his voice from the Encyclopedia of Arkansas Minutes, often heard on Ozarks at Large. Our conversation took place earlier this month.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. The 28th annual Dogwood Walk will be held Saturday, October 24th from 9 a.m. until noon at Gully Park in Fayetteville. This fundraiser includes activities and demonstrations for all ages. Proceeds to benefit Humane Society of the Ozarks Rescue and Adoption, Emergency Vet Care, Senior Citizen Pet Care, and more. 444-PETS or hsozarks.com for registration or more information.
If you'd like easy access to each of the interviews and stories you hear each weekday on Ozarks at Large, you can subscribe to our free email newsletter. Each afternoon, it arrives to you with links to each segment that was part of that day's show. You can sign up for free at KUAF.com. Tuesday night, the Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas and the Diane D. Blair Center of Southern Politics and Society will host a free virtual event with authors Myra McClary, and Jeanne Wayne. They'll be discussing McClary's new book, Becoming Robbie Lee. It's a novel about a 10-year-old girl in 1952 Arkansas exploring social justice and race. That event, free, Tuesday night at 6:30. There is a Zoom link on Facebook that will allow you to watch. Just search on Facebook for Jeanne Wayne and Myra McClary discuss Becoming Robbie Lee.
Welcome to today's Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report. I'm Paul Gatling. On the program today, we will hear from Arkansas's junior U.S. Senator. Incumbent Republican Tom Cotton is running for re-election this fall, and he spoke recently with Roby Brock about the campaign and several other state and national issues. First, though, some news about the region's largest law firm. Kutak Rock, a national law firm headquartered in Nebraska, is relocating its office in Rogers. The company has signed a lease agreement to occupy 11,400 square feet in the $30 million Northgate Plaza office building in Pinnacle Hills. Construction of the 117,000 square foot building was completed earlier this year on West J.B. Hunt Drive. Terry Poole, who is the managing partner for Kutak Rock's three Arkansas locations in Little Rock, Fayetteville, and Rogers, said the firm will take possession of the new office space in mid-November. Kutak Rock opened its Fayetteville office in 2001 with just two attorneys. In February 2016, the company opened a Rogers office on the first floor of the World Trade Center Arkansas building. Kutak Rock has 32 attorneys in Northwest Arkansas. Coming up after the break, we'll hear from U.S. Senator Tom Cotton on today's Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report.
Support for the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report is provided by the Arkansas State Chamber of Commerce and Associated Industries of Arkansas. The Chamber's mission is to promote a pro-business, free enterprise agenda and prevent legislation, regulation, and rules that hinder business. ArkansasStateChamber.com. Arkansas Blue Cross and Blue Shield. For more than 70 years, Arkansas Blue Cross and Blue Shield has used its knowledge and compassion to create healthcare solutions for individuals and businesses. More information at ArkansasBlueCross.com. First Security is proud to be only in Arkansas. They offer smart solutions for personal and business banking, plus convenient services and community investment. First Security, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Republican U.S. Senator Tom Cotton is running for re-election this year. He is facing a challenge from Libertarian candidate Ricky Harrington. The Democrat who filed in the race, Josh Mahoney, dropped out just a few hours after the filing deadline had passed last year. Senator Cotton sat down recently for a conversation with Talk Business and Politics Editor-in-Chief Roby Brock. They discussed several issues, including the senator's stance on issues 1, 2, and 3 that are on the Arkansas ballot. But not until after this question was asked.
You passed on a Senate debate at Arkansas PBS earlier this week. I'm not sure I ever really heard your reasoning for not attending that debate. Why did you choose not to go?
Well, Roby, I've been serving the people of Arkansas for 6 years now, and I think they know where I stand and what I've been working to do on their behalf, whether it's creating more jobs or cutting taxes or eliminating the mandate in Obamacare that fined over 70,000 Arkansans, protecting our border and protecting our communities from the threat of crime and drugs, working to hold China accountable for unleashing this pandemic on the world. That's the record I've established. It's well known. Arkansans know where I stand, and that's the record I'm happy to take into this fall campaign.
I have seen you campaigning in Iowa and Georgia for some of your Senate colleagues through your Twitter account there. Congratulations, you've been wearing a mask. I appreciate that. There has been some criticism leveled at you, however, from some that say you're not taking this re-election bid seriously. So are you taking this re-election bid seriously enough?
Well, Roby, I've been taking my service in the Senate very seriously for the last 6 years, and I have been working to build a record of accomplishment for Arkansans over those 6 years on creating more jobs and lowering the price of health care and prescription drugs for Arkansans. Now, Last year, I was very active out on the campaign trail. We had over 1,000 volunteers working. We had a lot of events. I was out around fairs and festivals across the country. Obviously, this year has been a little different year, unlike any other in politics, just like in every other walk of life, given the pandemic. You know, we haven't been able to have big rallies or go to those fairs and festivals, which have all been canceled. But we still have a very strong volunteer group that is working hard to knock on doors and make phone calls. We're helping people who might want to vote by absentee to get those absentee ballots in. So we are working very hard during this campaign. But it's just a very different kind of year than any of us have obviously ever experienced in politics and every other walk of life.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cotton also discussed the U.S. Supreme Court, particularly the nomination and presumed confirmation of Judge Amy Coney Barrett. Despite the controversy over the timing of the nomination, Cotton says he expects the next time Democrats hold the White House and the U.S. Senate, they will waste little time confirming judicial appointments that may exist.
It shouldn't be a surprise that when the American people elected Donald Trump as president, they knew exactly what kind of judges they would be getting. And then after the Kavanaugh controversy in 2018, which happened just a month before the election, we didn't just hold on to the Republican majority in the Senate, we expanded the Republican majority in the Senate. We were elected to confirm conservative judges to the Supreme Court and the other federal courts, and that's what we're going to do.
Not sure that was the only thing on the ballot in those races,
but
also the math was favorable for you too. But so conversely, when at some point in time it will happen, the Democrats will control the White House and the U.S. Senate, it will be within their power and legal means to put forth these judicial nominees as well for the Supreme Court. You won't have any problem at all with them doing the same thing that you guys are doing.
And that's the point that Senator McConnell made about the allegations of hypocrisy against him by the Democrats. In 2015 and 16, it was a very different circumstance. We had Republicans elected in 2014 to include here in Arkansas to put the brakes on the final 2 years of the Obama agenda. That included his nominees to the federal courts. So when you have divided government, you shouldn't be surprised that the party that controls the Senate doesn't want to confirm a bunch of judges from the president's party.
Even if they're qualified?
Well, we confirmed some of those judges then when they were qualified.
Well, not a couple of hundred of them, though. So, I mean, there were plenty of vacancies.
But it shouldn't be surprised. And if you have a circumstance in the future with a Republican president and a Democratic Senate, then I suspect the Democratic Senate won't confirm anywhere near 200 judges. And a Democratic president, a Democratic Senate one day in the future, then I suspect they'll confirm more of those judges.
Is that good government, though? I mean, is that the way government should work? I mean, should it be if you control all of the cards and all of the power, your way, but if it's a divided government, you shouldn't compromise?
Well, this touches on a deeper issue about the role the Supreme Court has taken on for itself in our society over the last 50 or 60 years. I think the Supreme Court has extended its reach far beyond what it should be. Most questions should be left to the people, acting through their elected representatives in Washington or in their state legislatures or local governments. The Supreme Court too often, though, has substituted its preferences for elected officials. So it's not surprising that there's so much political tension in these nominations where, you know, 50 or 60 years ago and back to the beginning of the country, these nominees went through sometimes on the same day they were nominated.
Yeah.
That's Republican U.S. Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas. There's much more of that interview with Roby Brock, and you can watch it over at talkbusiness.net. And sticking with Senator Cotton, both he and President Donald Trump appear well on their way to winning in Arkansas. According to a new Talk Business and Politics Hendricks College poll, 58% of likely voters surveyed say they plan to vote for President Trump. 62% said they will vote for Senator Tom Cotton's reelection. In other news this week, the 7th Annual Northwest Arkansas Technology Summit wrapped up yesterday. The event was held virtually this year with speakers from throughout the state and country. An estimated 1,500 participants registered for the event. And Gerald Harp has died. Harp was the last surviving child of Harp's Food Store's founders, Harvard and Floy Harp, who had 4 children. Gerald Harp worked for the Springdale grocery store chain for 45 years and retired as chairman and CEO in 2001, not long after he led the deal that transferred ownership of the business to its employees. Gerald Harp was 80 years old. For those stories and more, visit us online at nwabusinessjournal.com and at talkbusiness.net, where you can keep up with our reporting each and every day. I'm Paul Gatling, and that's the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report. Until next time, thanks for listening.
Oh, tomorrow on Ozarks at Large, we will look back at a week that was with Michael Tilley from Talk Business and Politics. And Becca Martin Brown, the features editor at the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette, gives us ideas for the weekend. There are haunted houses, outside live theater, virtual events, and she even has a scary TV show recommendation. Plus, Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Vrolik reports on how school districts and the state education department is trying to track down students that haven't shown up virtually for school. Those stories, our visits with Michael and Becca, and much more on a Friday edition of Ozarks at Large, tomorrow at noon and 7 on 91.3, or by asking your smart speaker to play Ozarks at Large to hear the most recent edition of our daily show.
This is Leah Uribe, Associate Professor at the University of Arkansas Music Department, expanding our musical boundaries with Sound Perimeter. We started today with a recording of one of the most cherished tangos of all time, Volver, interpreted by Aníbal Troilo and Astor Piazzolla from a 1970 recording for RCA Victor. Astor Piazzolla and Aníbal Troilo, along with Carlos Gardel, are considered the tango idols of all times, both in Argentina and in all Latin America. The Argentinian tango, a song, a dance, a lifestyle, was the result of other music styles' syncretism, including African rhythms and Spanish melodies. Tango is characterized for its melancholic content and the dancer's sensual and slow moves. I grew up listening to tangos and remember vividly my uncle's long nights of whiskey drinking, listening to Carlos Gardel and discussing lyrics and reminiscing. I believe tango was a way to process male emotions for their generation. In a recent trip to Córdoba, Argentina, I encountered the music of chapó. Chapó started in 2015 by violinist Valeria Andrea Martin and pianist Daniela Mercado, with the mission of honoring and maintaining the tango tradition while promoting local Argentinian old and new arrangers and composers. Let us listen to Chapó interpreting Recuerdos de Bohemia, a traditional tango written in 1935 by Enrique Delfino and Manuel Romero, arranged by Chapó's pianist and founder Daniela Mercado. Thank you. That was Chapeau Duo, violinist Valeria Andrea Martin and pianist Daniela Mercado interpreting Recuerdos de Bohemia, a traditional tango written in 1935 by Enrique Delfino and Manuel Romero and arranged by Chapeau's pianist Daniela Mercado. Chapeau's mission is to honor and maintain the tango tradition while allowing the genre to grow and expand in the hands of new voices. Chapeau's pianist Daniela Mercado wrote Ruta 40, Route 40, inspired by the famous National Route 40, a highway parallel to the Andes Mountains that connects Argentina from north to south. This composition also celebrates her 40th birthday and the paths traveled on the highway and through life. That was Valeria Andrea Martin, violin, and Daniela Mercado, piano, members of the Argentine duet Chapeau, interpreting an excerpt from Ruta 40, written by Daniela Mercado. If this music speaks to your heart, I have no doubt it did, check Chapeau, C-H-A-P-E-A-U, on Spotify or YouTube, and enjoy their takes on old and new Argentinian tangos, a genre that is here since 1920 to stay, evolve, and expand. This is Leah Uribe, Associate Professor at the University of Arkansas Music Department, expanding our musical boundaries with Sound Perimeter.
Por una cabeza de un noble potrillo que justo en la raya afloja al llegar y que al regresar parece decir no olvides hermano, vos sabés, no hay que jugar. Por una cabeza me tejón de un día de aquella coqueta y risueña mujer que al jurar sonriendo el amor que está mintiendo quema en una hoguera todo mi querer. Por una cabeza
todas las locuras. This is Ozarks at Large. What's better than having a cross-country program ranked number one in the country? Having two cross-country teams ranked first. The Arkansas women's cross-country team keeps their top ranking in the latest Boost Treadmill national rankings. The men's team jumps from number four in the previous poll to the top spot in this most recent edition. Both teams will travel to Baton Rouge on October 30th for the SEC Championships. Arkansas golfer Brooke Matthews is following up her first-place finish at the Blessings Collegiate Invitational earlier this month with a second-place finish at this week's The Alley Tournament in Mississippi. The Arkansas team finished ninth. Arkansas has just one event left on the fall schedule. That's in Georgia early next month. The Arkansas women's tennis team and the Razorback swimming and diving squads are the lone home teams with events on campus this week. The tennis team hosts the ITA Central Regional Championship tomorrow, and the red-white swimming and diving competition is tomorrow afternoon at 3. The soccer team is at Mississippi on Sunday afternoon. Both the football and volleyball teams don't play at all this weekend. Both will be home for games next weekend. And on this week's Shades of Jazz with Robert Ginsberg, we'll hear music from keyboardist and arranger Gil Goldstein, Diana Reeves, Ahmad Jamal, and more. Shades of Jazz with Robert Ginsburg can be heard Friday night at 10 on 91.3 KUAF. Then again Saturday from 11 a.m. until 1 p.m. on KUAF 3. In fact, you can hear encore broadcasts of all of KUAF's locally produced music programs on KUAF 3 every weekend. To listen, just tune in on your HD radio at home or in your car. You can also go to KUAF.com, or you can ask your smart speaker to play KUAF 3. And also at KUAF.com, a schedule of when those encore broadcasts are available on KUAF 3. And when KUAF 3 isn't playing locally produced shows, it's jazz around the clock. KUAF 3, another service provided by your public radio station.
KUAF is supported by United Healthcare, reminding Medicare recipients that the annual enrollment period is now through December 7th. More information regarding Medicare and supplemental options available at 1-866-865-3851 or online at uhc.com. KUAF is supported by The Momentary, presenting Nick Cave, Until. This exhibition is the artist's largest project yet, including thousands of wind spinners, a crystal cloud, and more. Open until January 3rd. More information available at themomentary.org.
This is 91.3 KUAF. Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Watts, Oklahoma. Go Engineers. 91.3 KUAF is a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. Ozarks at Large is a production of 91.3 KUAF. Antoinette Grajeda, a contributor to today's show, as was Leah Uribe. Timothy Dennis produced our show. Lee Wood produced this week's edition of Sound Perimeter. And our thanks to Roby Brock, Paul Gatling, and the entire Talk Business and Politics crew for providing today's edition of the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report. You can learn more at talkbusiness.net. This programming reminder, tonight at 8, the final presidential debate with President Donald Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden. Live coverage from NPR will include the entire debate as well as analysis afterward. It's 8 to 10 live on 91.3 KUAF. Thank you so much for spending part of your Thursday with us. You can always spend any time you wish with us if you subscribe to our free podcast through any of the major podcast distributors. From the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio, I'm Kyle Kellums. Take care of yourself. Talk with you soon.